Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the I Don't Know Running podcast, where we share our experiences that make running fun and sometimes not so fun. I'm Lewis, and I'm a self-admitted lazy ultra runner.
And we have Mitch missing today.
Mitch is missing.
So I'll jump right in. I'm Terrence Rubin with PT Sports Pro, and I'm a self-admitted physical therapist.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
And I'm Dave DiPrato, the clinical manager at PT Sports Pro.
Yeah, and we have Mitch not joining us today. The reason being is just the way schedules work out sometimes, and when we are able to get together and record, Mitch is off. Guess what he is doing?
Training again?
Running another marathon.
That's a training run for him, right?
Yeah, basically all his marathons are training runs. Yeah. But he is off running another marathon in Maryland. I kept saying Delaware. It's not Delaware. It's Maryland. He'd already done
Close.
Delaware. I mean, they are, yeah. But he is off doing the Salisbury, Maryland Marathon this Saturday. So he is traveling today. He's going to get there, or he traveled yesterday. He's going to get there today and run tomorrow and then shoot back home. So good luck to him. Hope everything goes well there. Mm-hmm. But we are here to talk PT Sports Pro. Another episode of You Don't Know What You Don't Know Until You're Told by these guys sitting across the table from me, because I don't know.
Gently reminded. Let's go gently reminded.
Gently reminded. Yeah, I need that like every month on my knee, I think. But however, today we are going to start diving into one of the things we did right when we introduced this was we said, hey, we want to hear from those who are listening. Right. Hey, what's going on? What are some problem areas that you have? Some just email us, message. And one of the first few things we got, we're going to actually discuss in the next episode. But in this episode, one of the things you guys have heard, and I actually want to ask the question before we get started into the subject that we are actually going to cover, which is strength training, more to come on that. I want to know steps per minute, cadence. Can we just talk about that a little bit before we get into strength training? And here's, let me explain my reason for questioning. This is going back years, training with some buddies, Brad Prime, who you guys know. One of the things he focused on was 180 steps per minute. And in my head, every time I think of that, I think of steps per minute has to be, at least, and explain to me, please explain to me, has to be pace specific. Because if I'm a marathon walker, there's no way I'm doing 120 or 180 steps per minute, right?
Wait, are you asking a question or are you adding
I'm telling
a colorful
you what
comment?
My thought. I'm okay. telling you my thought process on 180 because it seems to be this magical number, and I'm using quotes. 180-ish steps per minute, plus or minus, let's say 5. So then I think I'm at, let's say, a 7-minute pace. What should I be doing? Should I be doing 175? Should I be doing 180? Should I be doing 185? And then I go down the rabbit hole of what else comes into this. Well, I would imagine how much you go up and down would have to have something to do with that, because then that's telling you you might be doing fewer steps per minute, but not landing incorrectly. So then I start going down all these rabbit holes of, right, like, what should I be at?
Now, so are you sure you weren't a rabbit in your previous life? Because you sure as heck love the rabbit
living
hole.
A lot of those, I'm sure, yes.
Well, it's Easter, so we will entertain your
perfect,
question.
Perfect, yes. So let me just put it out there. What should we be focusing on as runners with steps per minute, cadence, and what are some ways that we can start building towards maybe a better cadence per runner?
Yeah, so I'm gonna zoom out of that exact number for a minute and help you understand how we see cadence, right? So if you own a car, where do you keep your RPM when you drive, right? And why do you have gears in the car? Mm. And every time when you change gear, what happens to your RPM?
Yeah, it goes down.
So, right. So let's say your car is most efficient at 1500 RPM. So you put it into first gear and your RPM climbs up to 6500. You drop it into gear. It drops down to 1500, but then climbs again until you get to that sixth gear where you're cruising along at 1500 RPM or 2500 RPM, whatever that number is. So in the same way, the body functions most efficiently at the right cadence. So to talk about what you just said, well, if I'm running at a different pace, should my cadence be different? No. Mm. The cadence will always be the same. You will adjust, your body adjusts to function at that optimal cadence or turnover.
Okay.
So, and this is now from a running standpoint.
Yeah, not a walk.
Not a walking standpoint. Okay. So people can actually run even at five miles per hour, which is like an 12 minute pace, and still keep a 180 cadence.
Okay.
They're just taking shorter, quicker steps. It's almost like a shuffling gait.
Yeah.
So just imagine that being the scenario, that answers the question as to should my cadence be changing each time I run a different pace? And the answer is not necessarily.
Okay.
The idea of good cadence is to improve efficiency.
Yeah.
An engine is not going to be efficient, even though it can sustain 6,500 RPM, it's not going to be efficient at 6,500.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is that it's going to burn more, right? Well, at the same time, if an engine is only idling and never driven, you're also going to affect the way that engine performs. So your body will be the same way, right? If you're running at a lower cadence all the time, it actually creates its own inefficiencies at that lower cadence. So in the research, in the science of running, this is how they came up with the performance of 180 strides per minute.
Okay.
Am I missing anything on just that component, Dave?
Not really. I was
yeah.
I was thinking the way I think about it anatomically too. Not to get too much off on the sidetrack, but really, cadence relates to how long your foot spends on the ground. And if your foot is spending a longer time on the ground, then what we don't think about is that your muscles are still stabilizing.
Yep.
During
the entire time that it's on the ground.
And so if your muscles are consistently stabilizing for a longer period of time, you're actually in essence working harder or stressing those muscles out more than if you were spending less time on the ground.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Even with more steps.
Yep.
Yeah. And on that same sort of wear and tear, you know, scenario, can you imagine if you compress a spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
You compress it all the way down every single time versus compressing it half the way down.
Yeah.
So if you compress it half of the way down, you've maintained some of the energy within the spring. If you get a full compression down, you've actually lose because the spring now has to build up all of the energy that is lost to create that rebound. In the same way, the foot mechanics and even the shoe mechanics, which is why we talked about shoes and the choice and why that's important. All of those things matter into how efficient you are in your running. So cadence, I think it's a great question. And that's why I don't want to just just blow over it. I want to make sure that the audience even understood exactly why we are instructed to do certain things. And not everyone's going to be hitting 180 right away. But if we can make that the target, right, then we can only build our efficiencies towards that. So in running, when someone comes to see me at the practice and we'll do a video gait analysis, we'll videotape their form, but we'll also use a metronome to see what their cadence is.
Okay.
A lot of the inefficient runners are in that 140 to sort of 155 cadence.
Okay.
And these are ones that, when I say inefficient, it doesn't mean that they don't run. These are guys that are still running.
Yeah.
Right? They're doing shorter distances or maybe even a marathon here and there, but their cadence is way off.
Yeah.
And they talk about all these other injuries that they're continuously dealing with. But when we switch them to the higher cadence, they are less likely to develop those injuries and we're seeing less of them in the practice.
That's what I was wondering too, is how much of that can be tied to, obviously you guys have mentioned this several times already on the podcast and we hear it all the time. Everything is so connected.
Totally.
We talked about it this morning with like an injury. Well, they complain about this, but it's not really that necessarily. Right. It could be completely different and it's all connected. So let me ask you this on the cadence, and I'm sure you're going to go into it more, but so is 180 the number?
Yes.
Should we be focusing on trying to get to 180?
Yeah.
And obviously not overnight. You're not going to go 145 to 180, right?
Maybe
you want to go.
So one of the things that, again, where we are in agreement on with our athletes when we train them, You may go to some practices that say, you know, if you're at 140, let's first try to get you to 150 and then we'll build up to 160 and 170, 180. Now, for us, we're like, this is a habit that needs to be broken.
Now you're going
to
just create more bad habits.
Exactly.
Okay, I gotcha.
Right? So let's just show you where that ideal is, right?
Wow.
And if 180 is your target, you're more likely to run at 165 to 170. But if 150 is your target, then you're going to run at 145, you know?
Sure.
So we really want you to appreciate this target. And so I'll set the metronome to 180. There's a free app that I have people download. Pro Metronome, they can set the dial to 180 cadence and you'll hear it tick along. And I'll tell my patients, okay, you start off with your running, you set the metronome and see if you can keep up with this. And you turn the volume up really high so you can hear that tick. And every time it's ticking is where you're taking that step.
Yeah.
And so what we find with most runners, what we mistake for efficiency is if you have a 100-yard distance. Now, is it more efficient to take 10 steps, 10 giant leaps to complete the 100 yards?
Yeah, right.
Or 30 smaller leaps to complete the 100 yards? What's more efficient on the body? So with the larger leaps, yes, you will complete it in fewer steps, but you're extending your body beyond its normal range. So you're hyper-firing your hip flexors to bring the leg forward. You're overstretching your hamstrings for the leg that's lagging behind. And so you're creating a whole string of inefficiencies in that higher cadence. Even if you notice a sprinter doesn't take 10 steps. They just bring their knees further up and power down to create the ground force reaction to propel them forward. So their steps are better because they're putting so much of force forward that it can leap them a further distance to the next step.
Yeah.
But they're not just stretching out their bodies over longer steps.
Right.
So that's something else that we try to train our runners to do is take shorter, quicker steps so that you can improve your cadence, which then improves some of your efficiencies and then also reduces your injury profile.
No, that's good. So what are some things that you would recommend on a, let's say maybe a pre-run routine to help you get you ready to try to increase those steps per minute?
So I focus a lot on helping my patients understand some basic dynamic flexibility drills, which is what we talked again about in the last episode. And there's three drills that I've found to really help. There's about 8 or 10 that we normally would recommend in a full set, but there's three drills that really helps to open up the hips and gets everything ready to fire on that faster cadence pattern. And the hip in, hip out movements.
Yep, we talked about that.
Yeah, those are two of the three. And the third one is a leg swing.
Okay.
So when you swing your legs through an arc of motion, repeat that 8 times on each side, that just loosens up your system enough to prepare you to then start keeping on that cadence. Then we recommend, okay, no matter what speed, remember we talked about speed is independent of cadence. So it doesn't matter what speed you're running, set your metronome in your headphones or whatever to that 180.
Okay.
And run for about 3 minutes and on that cadence.
Okay.
And then turn the metronome off and then see, can you keep up for about 5 minutes? And at the end of the 5 minutes, turn it back on and go, am I on cadence?
Yep.
So it'll take a little bit of rehearsing to do, but you'll find after a few runs, you don't have to even turn the metronome on. You'll just turn over perfectly in your system.
Am I going, should I expect to feel some different, and I'm asking this because I felt this. I feel like I felt this. Mm-hmm. I did a run, and Brad, he's like, "Man, I don't know how you're not you are." Because I'm at the time, I went out and did a quick 10 miler. I was trying to be like 6:50s or something like that. And he said, "Nice pace." And then he came back and said, "Man, I don't know how you're not injuring yourself." Because I was at like 160.
Uh-huh.
And he says, your steps per minute or your strides per minute are really pretty low for, you should be trying to increase that. And I said, yeah, I know I'm kind of inefficient there, blah, blah, blah. And it just started me thinking. So I said, all right, well, the next run, I'm going to go out and try and do that. I'm going to try and go 180. And I knew I had to be faster. So I just started doing some quicker steps through the run. But then at like mile, whatever, 4, let's say, I just took 30 seconds and started counting every other, doubled it, doubled it. And that gave me my steps per minute, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was closer. I was like 170, whatever, 5. got done with that run. I tried to maintain that. And, but man, the next day or like the next run, I felt like I was those either I'm using muscles that are different or maybe work harder to get me going quicker. Am I going to feel all this to say, am I going to feel something different as I work towards this? And is that just a part of the process of getting maybe some muscles firing differently? I don't know. Does that make sense what
yeah.
I'm asking?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, take that one. I'll give Dave this
there's
one.
Kinda, yeah, there's two aspects to that. Really, in general, anytime you change anything, especially the more drastic you change,
yeah,
you're going to expect to have differences with how your body responds.
Yep.
So yeah, if you up your cadence by 20 steps per minute, your body and your muscles are kind of saying, whoa, wait a second. Like I wasn't expecting that. I'm not prepared for that.
Yeah.
Therefore they have a little bit, you haven't used different muscles, but you've used the same muscles differently.
Yep. That's what I was wondering. Yep.
Yeah. And so then they're a bit more inflamed basically. So they just need to recover from that.
And then the other thing we notice is that the running form can sometimes impact, you know, that cadence, especially when you're trying to run it at a higher speed. Again, at a higher speed, your cadence is the same, but the form really matters. At a lower speed, you're still keeping the 180, but you can get away with a slightly not great form because your speed is lower. So at the higher speeds, people that tend to run more midfoot tend to do better at the higher speed, higher cadence. Because if you're running with a heel strike, and those are your two basic patterns, again, so your heel striking, each time you put your heel down, it's almost acting as a braking system.
Yeah.
And the only reason you end up putting your heel down is because instead of landing your step right below you on your midfoot, you're trying to stretch out for that little extra distance and you just sort of do it because that's the way you've always done it.
Yeah.
And if that's what you're doing, that will reduce your number of steps, your cadence, but can also make you more prone to injury. So Brad is correct in saying that, you know, that could lead to injury. However, when they've analyzed marathoners that are finishing in the top 50 or top 100, it's a split between who is doing midfoot running versus heel striking. So there really isn't any scientific evidence right now that I'm aware of that says that one form is better than the other. But what it does show is that certain forms do predict you to different types of injuries and certain forms do impact your cadence and your speed.
Okay. Okay.
And I also, kind of coming back a touch with cadence, that's where I really utilize and love to use the treadmill.
I was going to ask if that's a good place to work on it or...
Yeah, because if you can keep something constant, which that is speed.
True.
Then you're less likely, say if you were on the road, to increase your cadence, but then naturally increase your speed at the same time because your body isn't sort of accustomed to that cadence.
Yep.
So yeah, if you jump on the treadmill and you keep the speed consistent, then you can focus on your cadence and you should have a timer right there to then
help. I noticed when I was out and really quickly before we move on, going uphill and downhill would affect that, obviously. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm trying to stay at like 170 to 180, I was like, well, it's harder because you're speeding up, which means you naturally want to stride out a little bit on a downhill. And going uphill, I'm shortening my stride naturally, or in my head, that's what I do. Mm-hmm. And that means it impacts it there too. So I could see where like just getting on a treadmill and focusing on just one thing.
No inclines.
No incline, just very, very, I can see where that would help.
But again, all of these things, you know, like in the bigger picture of being an efficient athlete, these are little pieces that add to creating a better, stronger picture.
And then one final thing I wanted to get this out was, it's probably good to get somebody to look at you for that cadence, because I can only imagine, or in my head, I'm just thinking, well, okay, I'm just going to go run quicker cadence. But if you don't actually change your form some, you could just be impacting yourself and maybe in a more negative way. If I'm keeping the same stride, let's say I'm still heel striking and still keeping that same, but just doing it faster, that's not really improving. Well, maybe it is, but is there potential injuries there? Whereas if I came in and got looked at and said, hey, this is my stride. I probably want to maybe shift that to be more underneath me.
Yeah. And I think you're realizing as you ask this question that there's so much more to this than just a understanding, okay, if my cadence should be 180, I should run at 180. Right?
And that's where I'm going. Maybe should you be coming in and getting looked at?
So, yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about that in our next episode.
Perfect.
Because I think we'll cover the analysis. But just as an example, you know, we had someone come in to our practice that has been having a running injury for about 15 years. She's seen multiple therapists, clinicians, specialists that have stretched her ankle, her calf, and what have you. But when I laid her on the table, I'm like, do you know you have a leg length discrepancy?
Oh.
And so her right leg was about 5 millimeters longer than the left. And this is, we don't just jump to that conclusion. We run all of our tests, which would then correlate directly to her injury and why she's had it ongoing for so many years. So if you are trying to make these corrections at home and that is not analyzed well enough as to like, what is your anatomy? What is your, you know, injury profile? You could miss some really low-hanging fruit. And so by stretching the right muscles with her, I was able to give her enough temporary relief so she ended up running 7 miles on the treadmill. But the long-term for her is she's going to need a heel lift in the opposite on the opposite side to level up her legs so that that muscle on the injured side doesn't keep over-firing. So that's why you want to see a clinician, but not just any clinician. You need someone that actually understands running, that understands runners, that understands the human body, understands their therapy and how to intervene correctly.
Yeah.
So that's what we love doing. That's why we love doing this stuff.
Awesome. What are some things that we can use strength training-wise to get us in that neighborhood?
Yeah, you know, so when it comes to strength training, I think most people, I don't know, what do you think of when you think of strength training?
Let's see, general sense, strength training. Man, I'm at a loss. I honestly don't. Here's what I think of for me, a runner. I would probably think more strength training from a triathlete, maybe adventure runner type thing, but just in a running sense, I only think core exercises.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying
that's
fully what I think of.
Right.
Because what do you think of strength training? Well, okay. So if you ask me, doesn't matter, what do you think of? I would think of lifting some weights.
Right. And again, you don't, it's not even that I'm putting you on the spot.
No,
But your voice is the voice of many athletes out there, right? When you talk to a runner or a triathlete even, but a lot of times it's with the runners, you talk to them about strength training, like, oh, no. You know, I'm a runner. I just run.
Yeah.
And nothing improves running like running, right? But there's a fundamental base behind all of that. And especially in the kinds of lives that we've evolved into where we're mostly sedentary. We're sitting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we get up and we want to run and our body's unprepared enough to handle those motions. That's where a strength training program comes in. And then when people think traditionally of strength training, they think of lower body strength training because I'm a runner. I got to make my legs stronger. But when you run, do your arms stay still at your side? No.
Not at all.
They move.
Yeah.
And to be able to move those over 26.2 or more miles, you know, there's a component of strength and fitness that needs to be wound into that.
Yeah, I would challenge anybody to say that they did not feel their biceps at the end of a marathon. Mm.
Yeah.
Like you do. I mean, that's why you see people like shaking them out. I mean, you feel it. You know, you might not feel it for 10 miles. Maybe you do, but like, I know, man, most people, you feel that at the end of a marathon or longer.
Shoulders get sore because people hike the shoulders up. And
that's a whole nother subject we could talk about because I, depending on the week or the situation in my life, I can feel I am running like this. And it's, man, you just get relaxed. Right. But anyway.
But what you're just saying right now feeds right into what we're going to be talking about and why. So, for example, why do people shrug their shoulders up? Because there's a weight on our arms that if our muscles aren't toned enough to handle that weight, it's going to fall into other muscle groups. And this is why the strength training is important. So if you train those muscles to hold the shoulders where they need to be as you run and propel your body forward, you wouldn't need to hold your shoulders up because that becomes a secondary issue of moving your arms. So from a strength training standpoint, we work through very specific routines, both for the upper body and the lower body. I think we talked at length about the core in one of our sessions as well. So go and remind yourselves and review that, listeners. And that is the core is the basis of, you know, where we lay on the strength training, which is why we held this episode on until now. But there's certain sequences or caveats about strength training that we're going to share with you today, which is why I want to take a separate episode for that, because I think strength training is critical for any athlete. As scientists ourselves, we've experimented with no strength training, with strength training just the core, strength training just the legs, just the arms. And there's a notable difference, especially as you get into the longer distances.
I can see that.
And on the shorter distances, if you're running at a higher rate, you know, sub 25, you know, 5Ks and stuff, the strength training does matter there. If you do like a, you know, 35 and a 5K like me, then yeah, whatever. You're just kind of getting out there and sort of running.
Yeah, I can see that's why your sprinters look like they do versus long distance. Right. I mean, they're using the upper body strength to help propel them forward.
So then the big thing with strength training is, in a traditional sense, we think of heavy loads. And whenever I've mentioned strength training to any of my athletes, they'll say something like, but I don't want to bulk up my muscles. I don't want to have these big arms and big legs.
Yeah.
And I think what they're missing is, when we talk about strength training, it's about the ability of the body to get blood flow to all the right muscles and have them continue to contract and relax efficiently throughout a long distance, which is endurance.
Hmm.
So blood flow, endurance. What happens in a large bulky muscle is that you can increase the protein content of a muscle, the bulk of a muscle, without increasing the microcirculation, which is blood flow. And so if you have a higher protein content and not enough microcirculation, either your heart has to pump blood harder to get to those muscles, or those muscles are going to fatigue a lot more easily.
Ah.
So knowing that as
interesting.
Knowing that as a principle of strength training, what we recommend is, let's lay on a good foundation of microcapillaries. So microcapillaries develop when you repeat something at a higher rate, and your body builds in its own efficiency. So the initial response to any workout is heart pumps harder to get blood flow through there. When that system is continuously challenged, the body goes, wait a minute. Instead of me working so hard to the heart, let's build in more microcapillaries, right? So I can be more efficient.
Oh, the body's an amazing
thing.
The body
thing, is, which is why I love what I do. Like I can get so nerdy on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But you can almost visualize this microcapillarization of these muscles. And so there's a technique to do that, which we'll talk about. But when you have good circulation, good microcirculation, then you add in the protein bulk to a muscle, now you can understand why those muscles can get infused faster, and also any of the byproducts of a workout, which we call pain metabolites, that your body secretes, can also be removed from the area quicker. So recovery then becomes an easier issue.
Wow.
So no secret sauce really, but it's just us putting together all the pieces of information that people sort of know. Maybe some of you don't know this. But, you know, I've been working as a personal trainer and a physical therapist for 30 years. So there's a lot of that experience that comes into the fold. And I'm always challenging myself on different aspects of training and strategies. And, you know, sometimes even when I have all the answers, I'm not always following it, but at least I understand the why. And then I'm going, you know, I've always said, I've run a marathon with training and I've run a marathon with zero training. I've finished both. But it's much easier on my body when I train.
Yeah, so, one was a much better experience than the other.
So on that training mode, and the principle of high capillarization, what we've worked at is number of repetitions. So when we start off with any base training, there's two ways to approach it. You approach it with zero load on an exercise piece of exercise equipment, or you can calculate what we call the 10RM. 10 repetitions maximal. It was put together by a French scientist back in the 70s, where they wanted to calculate or figure out how do you work optimally for strength training.
Okay.
So, and we'll get down to specific equipments and drills, but just as an overall umbrella, your 10 RM, 10 resistor repetitions maximal, is how much of load can you put your body through in a certain muscle group? So let's say we're doing a shoulder press. How much of a load can I push straight up, controlled, and lower that load 10 times and not do a rep more? So let's say that number is 100 pounds. I can do 10 repeats. At the ninth repeat, I'm struggling to get that ninth one up. At the 10th repeat, I'm done. My number for the 10RM for shoulder press is 100 pounds.
Yeah.
So in that same example, if I got to 8 and I really struggled and I just couldn't get to 9, then I can either recalculate my RM or I can just say 100 pounds is too much. 90 pounds is my 10RM. So you just make a slight adjustment to that. And these numbers will matter as we make the weight selection for the actual workout. If you get to 10 and you're like, well, I can do 2 more, but then at 12 I'm done, then you go, you know what? I think maybe 110 or 115 is my 10RM.
Yep.
So back to that example, we'll do that for every muscle group that we want to work out. Now, there are lots of muscle groups in the body, but they do group together. And there is an efficient system in which you can work it out, or a sequence in which you can work it out that can be a little bit more efficient than just randomly doing things.
Yeah.
So for me, we all want efficiency. We don't want to be out there too long at the gym. So if we do a shoulder press, you work with the opposite muscle group, which is a lat pull.
Oh, okay.
If we do a chest press, the opposite muscle group will be a row. If we do a fly, we'll do a reverse fly. So those are the 6 muscle groups that you can work out together. And that becomes the structure of an upper body workout.
Huh.
And then when we look at the legs, same thing. You'll do a leg or knee extension. Then we do a leg curl. So we do both of these in seated. There is a prone leg curl machine that you'll see in a lot of the gyms, but that creates so much of instability to the core that it's hard to then focus on the muscle that needs the focus. So the seated leg flexion or hamstring curl seems to work better. Then we will do the hip abduction, pushing apart, and the adduction, pulling together. Those are the next two. Then we'll do a calf raise. You can do it either in standing or sitting. Each one works different groups of your calf muscle. And then we finish up with a leg press. So that sequence of leg extension, leg curl, abduction, adduction, calf raise, and leg press becomes the lower extremity drills.
Okay.
So now that you've got the sequence, which is a separate sequence for upper body, separate sequence for lower body, we figure out, okay, now how many repeats am I supposed to do and what load should I be working at? So here's the part that people miss. Your 10RM is now established, let's say, at 100 pounds.
Okay.
When you start off and you want to do high repeats to improve that microcirculatory system, we want you to start off at 25 to 40% of your maximum of your 10RM.
Yep.
So in this case, I chose 100 because I can do the math quite easily.
Yeah.
You start off with 25 pounds.
Yeah.
So 25 pounds, and each exercise may not be the same number. So 25% of that 10RM number is what you're going to use. So with the 25 pounds now that you're going to use at the 25%, you're going to do 30 repeats. Then 25, then 20. So this is not your grandma's 3 sets of 10.
Yeah.
We're at 20, 30, 25, 20. So we actually call it the 30, 25, 20 series at our practice. And what we've found over the years, that 30 repeats sounds like that's easy. I can do that. But you'll find that if you lack the microcirculation, which means that you don't have the blood flow to get to the muscle to work it out in that for that high number of repeats, or you lack the endurance of the system, or the system that can then flush out those metabolites that you're producing from the workout, you will not be able to do these repeats. And until you can do them efficiently, you stay at 25%.
Okay.
So some people may do 30, or they may not even make it to 30. They make it to like 20 or 25. Then they'll do like maybe 15 and then 10.
Yeah.
The goal is to build up so you can do 30, then 25, then 20.
Okay.
In each muscle group. And as you go through each of those routines, you can then increase your load once they become easy to 30%, to up to 40% of their 10RM.
Gotcha.
When you get to the 40% of 10RM, you've usually gone through between 4 to 6 workouts as you create the buildup. And so that becomes a phase of training, right? So we call that the high repetition phase of training. So from a strength training standpoint, you're going to have 2 main phases. You're going to have a high repetition phase and you're going to have a high load phase. So after you've gone through 4 to 6 sessions of the high repetition phase, you'll switch over to 60% of your 10RM, up to 75%, even 75 to 80% of your 10RM. and you start off at 60% and you switch over to 3 sets of 10.
Okay.
So now you're back to that traditional strength training.
Yeah.
So typically people start off with that load resistance training versus the repetition training. And when you don't have good circulation, it's hard to sustain or build on that load.
Interesting.
So as an experiment with a friend of mine, he stuck to the sets of 10. We started off with a base load for our training program. I did the 25%, worked it up. And within, I want to say like 8 weeks, I was able to switch over to the higher load, which is the 60% and above.
Yeah.
And I was able to surpass the load that he was able to do. Like, he couldn't progress as quickly as I did.
Right, right.
And so this was just a one-on-one little experiment that we did. But just seeing that and understanding the basic anatomy and the actual philosophy behind it really made the point of why the two types of training are necessary. And you want to, if nothing else, for athletes in this group that we're speaking to, at least focus on the high repetition training. But sometimes people think high repetition training is 3 sets of 15, and it's a lot more.
Right.
So that was the main message that I wanted to convey with the strength training program, you know, how programmatic we've created it to be. We actually have handouts at our practice that'll give you an upper body workout, a lower body workout. We haven't gotten to the point yet of uploading it to our website, but we welcome anyone that's interested in this to seek us out. And we want to help. We want to help you understand it and train you if we need to. And
I just love, I just love the explanation of the why, the high reps. Why do that? Because if I go back, as soon as you started talking about weights and repetitions and things like that, I went back to when I was in the Marine Corps. I had a good buddy of mine who was he worked at a gym in LA prior to joining the Marine Corps, and met him in Japan. And he just took me under his wing and said, "All right, Lewis, come on, we're going to hit the weights." And I was a skinny kid growing up. I've been skinny all my life. But he took me under his wing and started teaching me some things. I don't know what method he was using, but for me and what my goals were, I don't think we ever went over 10 reps. Now, it was a much different time back then. I mean, we're talking the early 90s when Metarex, I remember the supplement that I was using.
Oh, Metrix.
Called Metarex. Yeah, Metrix. Yeah. I don't even remember, but it was what I was, one of the fuels. Man, talk about rabbit holes. Do you know how many calories I was eating per day back then? It was ridiculous. Like we were on one of the best military bases in the military. Everybody knew about Yokosuka, Japan, because a lot of ships came into port there and they loved our mess hall. Our mess hall was the greatest. We had the best breakfast, period. ready made, whatever kind of omelet you wanted, any cereal you wanted, any, like, all the fruit, like, it was the best. Anyway, so that was my breakfast.
So how many calories were you having a day?
I have, I'm not even sure, but it was, probably not that. It was probably like 3 to 4 thousand, I would guess, in that neighborhood. I'm guessing because I didn't keep track of, I was in my 20s. I was like, I didn't keep track of that stuff. But I know what I was eating. It may have been a lot more.
Because you say that, and again, people are listening to this, are listening to my background as a physical therapist.
Yeah.
What they probably don't know is that I also did bodybuilding in my early 20s.
Okay.
And I remember, so I was having flashbacks to those, like, 7,000-8,000 calorie days.
Yeah.
And the hard body gainer protein shakes and, the raw eggs in the morning, because that's what everyone did, right?
Yeah.
We didn't know any better. We piled in the calories. I mean, I ate so lean that I remember in 1995, I got so sick because I didn't have enough fats in my body, in my diet, to digest some of my vitamins, that I ended up with like this viral infection. I mean, I lost like 30 pounds in 2 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
It was crazy. But my point is, again, I agree with you, is that we go into these things thinking on those terms of strength training, right?
Mm-hmm.
High calories. Very high weight, very low repeats.
Yep.
People, they'll do 3 repeats because they're so loaded. really going into that overstress. And there is, yes, there is a time for that. I'll do sometimes a down stack of, you know, 10, 8, 6, 4, 2. But you have to have the foundation.
Which
is hopefully that's what people are hearing today.
I at least had a decent foundation of the fact that I was in my 20s and very active in the Marine Corps. I had already done a ton of calisthenics at that point. And so I think my body was ready for what it was being given. But it was interesting. It made me think of that time and all the weightlifting that I had done. And man, I lifted my butt off for about a year, and just my body type, my build. Now, granted, I was in amazing shape at the end of that year, but I didn't bulk up. I didn't like gain, you know, 30 pounds of muscle. I was in great shape and it was great for me. I was really happy, but, all that to say, there's a lot of things you can do and the body is still going to dictate just that's how you are.
Yeah. Right.
So
there is a baseline to genetically how our bodies are going to develop and look. And so the things that we're recommending is not so that you look a certain way.
Yep.
It's so that your body can perform the other things that you're throwing at it, like the running, more efficiently, and especially the higher level events that we do, you know, when we start getting into Olympic distance, a 70.3 or 140.6 distance, you know, triathlons or ultra runs. And, you know, so this is where having a foundation of strength training is key, is critical. As a matter of fact, my winters, I spend more time from October to January doing more strength training.
I can see that.
And then the rest of the time, we're so busy training other components of our fitness. But having that base again is the other point that I want people to take home, is that, you know what, you got to figure out a base. You cannot just become good and strong in your event if you don't do other things outside of training for that event.
So. Yeah, and I definitely don't want people to think or feel that you will bulk up.
Yeah.
Well, I did want to come back to that.
Particularly, and if you think of it from a very generalized perspective, if you're a runner or a triathlete, endurance athlete, very focused in that regard, you're training some people train 7 days a week. And so essentially 95% of your effort is aerobic. And it's so you're not promoting muscle bulk and mass, right?
Yep.
So if you're even just tacking on what would be recommended of 5 to 10% max of higher loading, higher weight, lower repetition, for example, that's not going to bulk you up. And it would take a tremendously long time of that to really notice a difference. So it's really going to just improve your power and improve your efficiency.
Yeah. Look at what's his name that, I don't know why his name is slipping my mind. The Olympic marathoner for the United States who retired and bulked up. I think it's his name. Why am I?
Oh, is it? It's not. Was it Jordan? No, it was.
No, I can't think of his name. It'll come to me, I'm sure, after we hit stop. Anyway, he had made a comment about not hitting the gym, but he didn't. He wasn't saying don't hit the gym, because that dude. Olympic, he's the top, one of the top runners for America for several years in the marathon distance. He did cross train, he did strength train, but it was specific to like what you're saying, or like what you're saying for what you're doing. And so, but when he got done, he did change what he was doing and he bulked up, and you could see there was a difference in what he was doing and what he was trying to accomplish.
Right.
Yeah. You train totally differently.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to make sure again that whatever you're doing is appropriate to where you are.
Yeah.
So we often will have people that, you know, are getting into, like, say, a higher caloric meal pattern because they're training hard and they need those calories.
Yeah.
Except that they then, when they stop training as hard, they don't scale back on the calories and they wonder why they've gained weight. So everything has a balance, whether it's an injury profile, whether it's a strength or stretch or actual activity, there's a balance between all of these things. And sometimes it's hard for an individual to kind of fathom, like, how do I put all these pieces together? So I think it's critical that you seek the help of someone that can dial it in for you. We love doing that part of the time because, you know, we're just nerds on science. The other part is because we're out there doing these things. So we're dialing it in for ourselves. We'd love to help anyone else dial it in too.
Well, I just like how you explained it in the beginning. And I'm glad you clarified the not bulking up piece, because that's not what you're trying to do here. You're trying to get your body fit for what it's doing.
Right.
And I love the fact that you explained the reason behind working out those muscles, because that's why I brought up we never got around to it. The Marine Corps story was, I didn't have a clue why I was doing that. I just wanted to lift weights and look better. But the fact that you explained, hey, you should be doing this first, then your bulk cycle, or I say bulk, I shouldn't say bulk, but weight wise, it's heavier load cycle.
Rep cycle, load cycle.
Opening those capillaries,
microcapillaries.
Microcapillaries, in order to receive the blood correctly from the heart, so the heart doesn't have to work as hard, the muscles don't have to work as hard. That is overall good for a long distance runner or endurance athlete. Yeah.
Right.
So that to me, just that opened my eyes. I didn't know that.
Right. And to the listener again, you know, we are doing some very high-level summarization of much deeper ideas and thoughts. So I want to make sure that they don't just run away with, oh, you know, you said this. It's like, understand that there's a lot more behind a deep conversation like this. But, you know, the whole point of these conversations with PT Sports Pro is that we want to educate our public. So hopefully you leave this session going, I know a little bit more. Maybe I want to explore that further. Or maybe I understand enough to make a few changes. But, you know, you want to be able to adjust your programming if you don't have this balance.
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, I think given what you've given here today, I think that people can take something away.
Yeah. Well, there's been another great episode of, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah. And hopefully you know a little more.
This is Terrence Rubin with PT Sports Pro, and now you know.
This is Dave, and enjoy your lifting.
All right. Thanks, guys.